I've been trying to write a bunch of different things and having a great deal of trouble. One set of things around Lauren, because we're trying to do this special issue. Another of things in response to the election, because I am really tired of so many of my old friends, you know, spending all their time talking about how we could have won. I'm just really getting sick of it and wanted to. What happened? I thought at one point some people wanted to make a revolution, and now all you want to do is get another 1% vote. And
the good thing about 2024, I'll say now that it's in the rearview mirror, is we did have an election, but we didn't have to deal with Bernie Sanders this time and Bernie Sanders people this time, right? It's the last two elections, so going back almost a decade, we had to deal with, John, what you're talking about, which is like the progressive wing of the party, which now brands itself as like democratic socialist or whatever, convincing all of the rest of us that their work inside the party was going to bear fruit, and that a Bernie Sanders candidacy or an AOC candidacy or whatever the case may be, AOC and the squad getting leadership positions within the Democratic Party was going to lead to something like socialism. We didn't really get a lot of that this time. It seems like what was her name? Kamala Harris? Yeah, it seems like she kind of spurned the left, right? She didn't really do much in terms of...
If you had Liz Cheney, why do you need the left?
Yeah, right.
You know, actually, my experience was related to that, and that it had to do with, you know, for as long as I... The last time I voted, I think, was one of the times that Jesse Jackson ran, and with my kids were giving me a really hard time about, why don't you vote for him?
Rainbow Coalition.
So anyway, so since then, for 30-odd years, every time I have conversations during election season, I have to tell people I don't vote. And they look at me like, what? Yeah. You don't vote? I mean, how can you not vote?
We know about that. it's far more condescending when you're a young person.
The whole rigmarole, once again, about why not, whatever, okay? And I kind of tried to have this notion of, like, voting has become like a mark of civic virtue. I mean, it was, you know, I remember when I was a kid, my poor mother, okay, virtually no understanding of politics, okay? And whenever someone would ask her about who you voted for, she'd say, I vote for the Democrat. She didn't understand there was any other choice. That was it.
Anyway. We are here for our first episode of 2025 with John Garvey from Insurgent Notes and former editor of Race Trader and friend of the show, basically a member of the show.
At this point, yeah.
Thank you. I'm back. Jonna,
welcome back.
Jonna, thank you, guys.
A big fan favorite. It's good to have you back.
Oh, always good to be here, guys. Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And I guess today we're going to be talking about the new year, maybe do a little forward-looking, some predictions for 2025, or just checking in on the vibes. The vibes are not good, IMO, but... Maybe you two are more optimistic. You were a little optimistic after the election. I don't know how you're feeling now, Jonna.
Yeah, it's so funny. You know, I'm just coming from actually a happy hour with some friends.
Nice.
That's optimistic.
Have some more water, please, as much as you'd like.
Thank you. And it's, I don't know, it feels weird, right? I think there's the vibe is weird, I would say. And it almost feels like the quiet before the storm. I mean, just like in a few days, we're going to see... You know, Trump in office, and everyone is kind of perhaps bracing themselves for all the madness and uncertainty. So I definitely see a lot of people, turning away from news and actually just trying to live in the moment and just have fun and just like really not paying attention to what's happening because they kind of know what is coming. And it feels scary, uncertain. So I would say the vibe is more weird than anything.
How was... New Year's for you guys, because I am ill, so I wasn't really able to go out. So I only got a sense of what it looked like on the ABC Dick Clark's Rockin' Eve. He's dead, but like his legacy lives on in the Rockin' Eve. And the only thing I'll say about that experience, I was sitting on this couch right here with the fireworks and the dog was freaking out with Rax and we were watching, is that at one point they're juxtaposing like a blow-by-blow account from Eric Menendez of, like, the sexual assaults that his father put upon him, and then like juxtaposing that with all these murders and like serial killer things, like cold case file stuff. They had that on one screen, and then on the other screen it was like revelers like cheering with their Planet Hollywood like party caps on. And Rax took one look at it and she said, I don't use the word dystopian a lot, but this is really dystopian, and like walked out of the room. So what did you guys, I don't know what you guys got up to on New Year's, but did you feel a dystopian vibe out there? Is the vibe off in real life or just like in politics or in like the media? What do you think?
I always have a good time.
So. Okay.
I had a good time. I went, you know, I danced, I listened to some music. Yeah, but I also saw a lot of, maybe it's also my generation getting
that
a
little. That sorry, her vibe's off tonight.
I think maybe it's also, you know, as I get older, I just saw a lot of people staying indoors. People are like, I'm trying to save money.
That's a vibe.
Let me tell you, it's like, it's expensive to go out on New Year's, right? So I saw a lot of people like staying in, chilling out, vibing at home, going to bed early. But I don't know, maybe that's because of my age too now.
But that is a vibe though. I mean, like staying in, not being social, like deciding it's too expensive, too much, you know, inflation's been too much this year. Got to stay in with like my significant other or alone, like watch television. That is a whole vibe. What about you, Andy?
We had a party at Woodbine, co-sponsored by the ILC. It was a very nice party, very good. Vibes were fine. I was a little stressed because I was kind of organizing the thing, and so I had to make sure everything. So I didn't get to party as much as everyone else did, but I feel like I paid my dues.
With a vibes
by
fucked.
Organizing a good party. The vibes were fine, I think.
Oh, there's like a party vibe.
Yeah, all there right. was good DJs and like fireworks in the street, so the party spilled out into the street okay. for the fireworks, and yeah, it was a lot of fun, partying with the neighbors.
So getting up to stuff that's like normal. Okay.
Yeah. What about you, John?
I did nothing. Oh. I mean, one of the things that has been preoccupying me for the last couple of months is I get really, really tired. And part of that I think is related to some medications that I've been taking. But I don't think it's only that. And I just come 8:30, 9 o'clock, I just want to crash. I just want to.
You and me both, brother.
I don't even want to watch TV. That's.
I sundown around 8:30, 9 o'clock myself. I will say day after, New Year's Day, because we didn't do anything on New Year's Eve, so I've got no vibe check whatsoever on that, except the terrible vibes we saw on the television. We had an ILC event where we went down to the harbor and read from Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass.
Wow.
The book of poetry. We, like, spat at the harbor. Spat at Lady Liberty. It's been 170 years since this book has been written, this book of poetry. It's been, what, 100 and something years before Lady Liberty, you know, trolled her way into that harbor over there. What do we have for all this shit? So we were like upsetting tourists probably maybe with our poetry and, you know, being weirdos. You can't even really access the harbor anymore. So we were standing next to a heliport, like trying to yell Walt Whitman words. So it was kind of weird.
Whitman liked America though, right?
He was like the artisan Republican American guy. Yeah, he was all about athletic democracy, as he called it.
I thought you were doing this as a sort of like nostalgia of like transcendentalist patriotism.
Nah, patriotism. Patriotism's corny as hell. It was like kind of counter programming the party that you threw. I wanted to have it at dawn. Just to like be like, screw you guys and your party. We're gonna get up early on New Year's and we're gonna read Walt Whitman. It's like three people.
Oh, okay. So that
it did not ruin
it.
Your party. Yeah. Something else describes that.
Although definitely shout out to Mike, who stayed at the party very late cleaning after bartending and then showed up around noon to finish cleaning.
Yeah,
there was a lot of cleaning.
We heard about that. Yeah.
But a couple very weird things did happen on New Year's Eve, or maybe like early New Year's Day. Around the same time, there was this horrible terrorist attack.
Oh, yeah.
In New Orleans, claimed by ISIS, or so they say.
Allegedly.
And then almost simultaneously, a rented Cybertruck exploded outside Trump Tower in Las Vegas. And the details about this are still coming out, but this, you know, the second this Cybertruck thing is truly very bizarre. And I feel like it's like almost a work of art, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what little we know so far is that this is a military guy, not active duty, but, you know, part of the army, who is a Trump supporter, like a recent Trump voter and Trump booster. And he's doing this bizarre thing where he rents a Cybertruck, fills it full of fireworks and explosives, shoots himself in the face,
yeah,
and then explodes the Cybertruck,
yeah,
as if to destroy Trump. What the fuck is that? I don't know.
But it is a Tesla.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very, like, you know, very meaningful.
They're so ugly.
The symmetry of it is kind of, it's like it's a painting.
Musk vehicle in front of Trump Tower.
It's like,
absolutely.
Seems to be a commentary on the factional disputes within the Trump administration.
Which I've been following with, like, great interest, honestly.
It's almost like a situationist prank or something like that. But no, it's just some psycho military guy. Maybe it's just, I mean, with something this weird, calling it a psyop is almost Occam's razor. Like, what the fuck is this?
Well, you know, people have started speculating online, and I don't know, that's like the death knell of rationality, speculation online, because people are all the way down into, like, Fort Bragg is like a programming place for, like, psyops to, like, turn soldiers into killers, and that's where,
I mean,
all
PTSD,
the school shootings
does do that, so.
Yeah, like, and then the smarter people are like, well, all of this is like imperial blowback of some, in some way, shape, or form. These are, both of these terrorist acts were like former soldiers. Yeah. I think it's important to, like, keep our heads screwed on. There are people out there, and I'm not saying it's like the feds. I'm saying it's people online who are trying to screw your head up, trying to mess you up, trying to get you to, like, chase, go down a rabbit hole. Nobody has enough information right now to know anything that's going on with these two attacks. The important thing is we don't get dragged into, like, global war on terror part two,
yeah,
over this stuff, or get so, like, conspiracy brained that we start to lose our faculties and be able to understand and think about things in a rational way. Because the world is understandable, you know? That's one of the like postulates that we have, right, as communists, is that the world is legible. You know, it may be complicated a lot of time, but, like, it's not a grand conspiracy. Like, the world is understandable.
I mean, I've been thinking about the two events, the kind of, and then obviously in connection with the United Healthcare murder from a few weeks ago. And I was trying to make a distinction between targets, which I think that is a fair case to make. The United Healthcare guy was a target. The people on the streets of New Orleans were targets. And then whoever it was that was staying at that hotel, although it may have been more the hotel rather than the people who were in it, was also a target. And for us, we actually, there are times when targets are probably valuable and important and need to be taken advantage of, but they're not ever as important as goals. Mm. Goals need to instead be something that there is some strategic value in accomplishing, because it's going to enable you to be somewhere else to accomplish something else as a result of that. And I think that an enormous number of people in various kind of configurations on the left have kind of adopted a sort of a sense of goals, of that goals is just what happens to kind of cross your eyes in front of you, and you grab onto it and you do it for a while. So we were talking before a little bit about the election. The election was the goal. What was the goal? Well, the goal was to win. It was to stop Trump. But why? What were you going to do with it? What was it going to enable you to do that you otherwise were not going to do? So I think that there's an important place for people to learn to think more strategically about what it is they are thinking and advocating that people should be doing, as opposed to just a kind of a deep absent-mindedness about it all.
Mm.
Yeah, I also think, like, I was on social media when all of this was happening, and somebody posted, like, damn, we can't just get even 24 hours of the new year without some, like, wild shit happening in America, you know? And I think that speaks to the fact that, like, it is a very normal, I mean, I hate to say it, it's very tragic, people got hurt, but it's pretty much on brand what usually happens in the United States, right, when we think about these acts of violence that occur all the time, right? And the fact that, I mean, it is significant that it's happening in the new year, right? Like, I think definitely it seems like from the little I've read of what happened in New Orleans, like, you know, the guy clearly is also going through stuff, right? Like divorce, losing money, right? Like there's all these like contradictions and then how people deal with it. But it also seems like so American. I hate to say it, right? Yeah. It's like, I mean, 24 hours did not pass without like an act of violence kicking off the new year, you know? So.
And a particular, very familiar type of violence too, right?
Yeah.
Like this self-destructive violence that seeks to take out as many people as possible with you. But like for one brief moment, an individual becomes like a superhero, becomes like a video game character, becomes important enough to actually have an effect on the world, an effect on people's lives. Of course, the effect is to destroy life, is to harm people, is to hurt people, random people, or often targeting random people, innocent, quote unquote, people. I don't know who's innocent anymore. We're all kind of guilty in our own way, I guess. But innocent people. No, innocent people. Innocent people. Like people who didn't have anything to do with anything in New Orleans.
You're a little Joker-fied.
I am a little Joker-fied.
Somebody watched part two.
I didn't see part two.
I'd be willing to grant that Sean is guilty.
I consider myself guilty.
Andy is as innocent as the driven snow.
He's part of the labor aristocracy.
Beefo, right? I mean, he has that book, right, where he talks about like the heroes, right, and like kind of like this late stage capitalism and how like people engage in these like, you know, terrible acts of violence, right? And for sure, and I think that's what makes this distinct a little bit from, I mean, in so many ways from my man Luigi, my boo.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, like a lot of people noted that, right? Like he had the chance to detonate a bomb, right? To do, excuse me, other things. And he just literally chose.
Tapped him.
Yeah, just, just one act. So I thought, you know, the media response to that.
Yeah, what you're saying, Sean, it works really well with Anselm Yappe's thesis in Self-Devouring Society.
Mm.
This is a book about narcissism. We had him on the show last year, so definitely go back and check that out.
Year in review.
Check out that book. Yeah, about the sort of narcissism of that's like endemic throughout our society, but like helps explain the school shootings and that going postal, that kind of thing. And I think generally we're going to continue to see this proliferation of these kinds of mass violence, politicized events, because obviously on all the election postmortems, the sort of conclusion that was reached is like, well, people are really mad. The Democrats were not speaking to that anger and Trump was, so Trump edged it out. But even people who are mad aren't necessarily assuming that Trump is going to help them because they're also mad because of Trump.
Mm.
And so you see things like a Trump voter, a Republican, trying to murder Trump, you know, earlier yeah. this summer. And then this Trump guy. So my interpretation of this, and I can really only interpret it kind of aesthetically, just reminded me of January 20th, 2017, when Trump was inaugurated. Yeah. And we saw this like anarchist and, you know, movementist mobilization to D.C. to counter the inauguration. And the big image from that was a burning limousine on K Street with the words "We the People" spray painted on it in gold. You know, just a beautiful, expressive image that everyone who took part in that image, from the spray painting to the burning to the riots that led to it, were expressing their politics in some sort of way. And whatever the fuck happened in Las Vegas was also an expression of this person's politics or feelings. But what was it? It's the Cybertruck, which is this symbol of like a bourgeois futurist vision of a future that's both utopian and dystopian simultaneously, where you need this like Mad Max truck to survive, blowing outside of Trump Tower, who's this real estate mogul who's taken state power in Las Vegas, which is just a symbol of fictitious capital.
Sure.
It was a deeply... the hospital is calling. I need to take this. Continue talking. I'll continue my thought.
Yeah, yeah. No, take your phone call, Andy. I think you're steering things in a very interesting direction. Hello. To all of you sitting here in front of me and all the people at home, I feel I have to now defend myself and what I said about maybe they're innocent or not. Maybe I'm innocent. Maybe I'm guilty. Whatever. I don't know. I've been through in this year that's passed us, 2024, been through a near-death experience. That's kind of like sharpened my bullshit detector, maybe, or maybe I'm Joker-fied, or I don't know what the case is. But I'm like, I began this year, 2024, being a bit of a disbeliever in the whole concept of justice. Justice always seeming like blind and seeming like something that's impossible to fight for. Maybe we fight for power, if not justice, right? Justice is a tough one. But like more and more, I've seen this tendency to ascribe good or bad or guilty or innocent or like to pass judgment upon whole people, whole movements, whole trends. And I'm sick of it, good or bad. I don't think what's interesting about the world is like who's guilty or who's innocent. I think what's interesting about the world is the way that we're all connected with one another and how that humanness, that human connectedness, the way that capital binds us all together in like this society of labor, society of commodities. What's interesting is the way that like our connections with one another implicate all of us in all the things that are happening, make all of us guilty or make all of us innocent and force all of us to confront one another as moral agents, as political agents, certainly as economic agents. And that the only way that, you know, to understand the world truly is not to look at things in terms of like who's guilty, who's innocent in this particular case or in general. Was the British Empire responsible for slavery or for its abolition? This is like a debate that goes back decades and decades and decades, and you have people lining up in very predictable ways about things. The answer, of course, is that it's both, and that the question of the British Empire itself is dodging the true question, which is bourgeois society and capitalism. Is it guilty of creating slavery, or is it the means by which slavery was abolished? The answer, of course, is that it's both. So I'm not prepared to say that the people who were killed in New Orleans were innocent or guilty. I don't know who they are, but I know that they're implicated. Just as I'm implicated, as all of us are implicated in the type of society it is that creates the type of guy that blows himself up in a Cybertruck outside of Trump Tower, or what did the guy drive his Ford F-350 into a crowd of innocent people in New Orleans? We're all implicated in that in one way, shape, or form. And the only way out of that is together. Cornball, I know, but that's my feeling on the whole thing.
So, Sean, can you say a little bit more, though, about, I thought you were going to go in a slightly different direction, about the focal point on individual moments.
Okay? Yeah.
So, in other words, that was, I know less than anyone else about what actually happened on the streets of New Orleans, other than glimpses of reports and whatever, okay? But there was that moment, okay? Someone drove a truck and killed people, and we know a little bit more than that. Same thing that happened in Las Vegas. A similar thing happened in Las Vegas. Are those the right things at all for us to be looking at and talking about? Just because they happen to be put on those dopey screens that we watch all the time.
Yeah, right? Maybe. Think maybe about not.
How much of, I mean, like when you kind of listen to the report, like on CNN or MSNBC, the kind of the sort of the security expert, okay, or the former director of counterintelligence for the New York City Police Department is with us, okay? Can you help? What do you think they're doing now? They're trying to find out why he did what he did. Oh, really? That's what they're doing right now. They're trying to find out, you know, I could have told you that, and you didn't even have to pay me any money. But I just want to emphasize is that we need to become better at learning to do other things with the stuff that happens to, along the way. Let's imagine that since in the last 3 days, whatever it was, that neither one of those events happened. There was no New Orleans and there's no Las Vegas. All right. What would we be wanting to talk about with each other or with potentially millions of other people about the state of the world without this kind of accidental fodder that's fed into us, okay, that we can sort of speculate about. We can say, I wonder why he did it, okay, or whatever.
What does it say about society? Or were the people that he killed innocent?
And are we prepared to have those conversations if we were able to try to imagine doing them? Do we have the social context to do them? Do we have the kind of the physical wherewithal to do them?
Are you saying that we would be talking about like the Amazon strike or like the, you know, Trump administration's executive orders or climate change?
I think, Andy, that those are questions for us to have in advance, okay? Rather than, I don't have simple answers to offer you, but I do know that we political organizations and political individuals need to become more accustomed to taking seriously discussions about what maybe we should or should not be doing, and not just stumble about and just work with the stuff that's fed to us.
To be proactive instead of reactive.
And I mean, I think the realities of American life, especially, is that unfortunately these acts of violence, as we've been saying, like, they are going to continue. But I think if you add to that social media and you add also the moment that we're in, which we're a month away from another set of spectacles beginning, which is going to be Trump carrying out those deportation orders.
Oh, yeah.
I think it feeds into like this almost like this moment, or like this moment that we're going to enter. Right. It seems like I don't know, especially if you pay attention a lot to like social media, it just feels that it's been kind of a rough year. 2024 has been a rough year and there's been no breaks. And there was like this moment of brief respite, you know, the new year, and then boom, these two incidents. So I'm with you, John. I think it does take away from the kinds of conversations we'll be having, but I just don't think that they're going to go away. Like, I think these things are going to happen. So I guess what you're asking is like, how do we not fall into the trap?
I'm not arguing that they're not going to go, away, right? Yeah. I'm trying to imagine what will we do? I talked to, 20 minutes or so ago about, being disgusted with having to talk to people about the election, people who want to talk about one or another aspect of the election. And one of the things I said to one bunch of friends is, well, what would you be talking about if there had been no election? I mean, would you just have closed up shop and said, well, there's nothing really new?
I'd be talking about the price of these eggs. $8? Goddamn. Like, I'm going to Whole Foods.
John
like,
votes for eggs.
Just Egg is cheaper, by the way, if you'd like
to. Also, huge, we went to the supermarket yesterday, huge shortage of eggs because of the bird flu thing happening. So we were talking about the economy is what you're saying. We would talk about the economy instead of politics, but politics is the economy because the price of eggs was one of the biggest issues in the 2024 election.
Next issue, animal liberation. All right. Well, just to finish up, the thing I want to say about the Cybertruck is I guess this kind of aesthetic interpretation is pairing those two burning car incidents from the dawn of the first Trump term to the dawn of the second Trump term. I think it represented the sort of like how far we've come in terms of any sort of optimism that like cooperation and like let's think about these problems and organize and do things together seems plausible to people, or seems like that is the way of the future. Because on one hand, you get a movement, a black bloc, a riot. You know, maybe we'll see something a little bit like that on J20. I know that something was called. I don't think it'll be very big. But now instead, you see these sort of, diffuse, bizarre actions taken by people who don't really have coherent politics or coherent goals. It seems like everybody is sort of driven towards a kind of narcissism, or at least a pessimism, that there is any solution to any of these problems and that we're all just incredibly fucked. And the only question left is the time and place of our death.
And whether it's by our own hand or somebody else's.
I think that's how people feel.
No.
That's going to make it very hard.
I mean, I'm
so organized.
I'm laughing, but I'm laughing in the same way that I laughed on New Year's Day. We were downtown in Manhattan having finished yelling at the Statue of Liberty, having a cup of coffee, and somebody looked at their phone and said, oh, somebody blew up a Cybertruck instead of in front of a Trump hotel. And we all kind of did like a little crooked smile, and we're like, you know, because it meant something, right? You know, you could immediately, you're like, oh, I see. Somebody did something. And then for a second, everyone's like, yeah, they did something. And like, anyways, moving on, you know, because like that is the way that we relate to events now is immediately the intention question of it, right, is kind of already on the surface. What was the intention? The intention was to juxtapose an exploding Cybertruck, Elon Musk, with Trump Hotel to point to like the bizarre coalition of tech capital and I guess real estate capital represented by Donald Trump that is this incoming administration. To say what about it, nobody knows, right, yet, or at least we don't know yet, but everybody recognizes the move, right? And it's a very spectacular move because it immediately makes this juxtaposition real by killing people, by killing yourself, by blowing something up. All of a sudden now, like, the intangible becomes an event. And I'm kind of sick of that too, honestly. I'm kind of sick of my own reaction to that being like, oh, haha, yeah, I see what they did there. It's like, and I think I'm agreeing with you, John. It's like, we don't have a venue to talk about this stuff. We get like little push notifications on our phone, and then we can go on social media and sound off about it for like a little bit, and people can make speculations, but we don't have like a party. We don't have like a club. We don't have a revolutionary trade union movement where we can sit down and like actually talk about these issues in a way that's proactive as opposed to simply reacting as individuals to the latest spectacular violence or event that happened to somebody somewhere, which we wouldn't even know about if it wasn't for the internet. If it wasn't for the internet, what happened in New Orleans would have stayed in New Orleans. What happened in Vegas would have stayed.
Well, there's newspapers.
Yeah,
but it would have appeared the next day, and it would have appeared, yeah, you know, as like a smaller headline, as like a human interest, like man kills himself in front of hotel. And then, you know, it'd go off across the wires, and people would kind of take that in over the course of a couple days, maybe discuss it over the water cooler, and then it would be over. But we're inundated these days. You know?
I mean, I agree. I think there is definitely a weirdness. There's people are really turned off by politics, but I think they're turned off by, I would argue more like electoral politics. I don't know. I don't know about you guys, but wherever I go, I hear people talk about politics in a different way. They talk about people are talking about their day to day lives. They're talking about like messed up things that are happening. They're definitely talking about the weirdness of the political moment we're in. Especially after the election, a lot of people were talking about how messed up the Democratic Party was and how, I mean, come on, when are we going to see that the two-party system is messed up? So I don't think that there is definitely a nihilism for sure, but I don't think that people are just completely disinterested. But I think they're disinterested in a particular kind of way of talking about politics. And I think we have to remember that in 2016, you know, even though, yeah, for sure, the, you know, the Black Bloc, this was still within the shadow of the Democratic Party pushing the resistance against Trump.
Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, now they've kind of folded. They're like, I don't know, letting him and Melania pick out like Christmas lights and stuff, you know? So they're like, I don't know. So I think for sure, whatever resistance happens is going to look different. It may not be the big J20, but I don't know. I don't have that kind of level of pessimism about people like resisting to the fucked up stuff that is going to happen. You know, I do think people are just seeing the response to our boy Luigi. Mm. You know, I just like people are talking about these things. They're just not talking about it in the ways that we're used to, right? Because so much of, I don't know, like so much of 2016 was framed for about like was framed in terms of like the Bernie and the aftermath of like, you know, this was the beginning of DSA, right? I mean, like, so it's just like a different moment, I think. But I don't think that people are completely disinterested. They're just disinterested in electoral politics.
Yeah,
I
agree.
Yeah, I agree.
So can I, a couple of questions. One is, which, I mean, when you say people are,
I'm talking about me and my friends. I'm kidding. I'm like, so I'm my girl's from Happy Hour.
Important demographic.
I told them I'd give them a shout out.
Is an important demographic. You
okay.
Need to know
we don't really have a kind of a somewhat larger, more global kind of, you know, sort of scan to know what are people up to, you know, that we can speculate, we can guess, we can put things together and probably know more rather than less. But I also wanted to add is, how sure are you that Trump, all this bad stuff is going to unfold over the course of the next relatively short period of time? As opposed, for example, from my bet, okay, it's chaos is what's going to unfold. Yeah.
I agree with that.
Political chaos, not chaos of, it may be chaos in the streets too. We'll see about that. But is chaos going to be just a whole sense of all fucked up kinds of contradictory decisions and impulsive thises and that, and plus sheer inability to get things done? I mean, I kind of, if he has not figured out what to do with J.D. Vance yet, has allowed Musk to kind of basically kind of move in and take over, maybe even to bed with Melania, I don't know, it's really quite striking. And I think that he may very well come next Monday not be able to have his election results certified because of the same moment in history of 4 years ago. It's January 6th. When the Congress is supposed to convene to vote to certify the results of the election. He can't go forward to his inaugurational spectacle until that's happened, but he can't have that if Johnson has not been selected Speaker of the House.
Mm. Oh, I'm not following that.
Yeah. He's trying to...
They'll figure it out.
In the paper today, they were saying Johnson's trying to rally... trying to bring the House Republicans together, but he's having a hard time with it because the coalition, as you think you're pointing to, John, is a very fractious one. Varn and I talked about the H-1B-1 visa thing, the big blow up, like the tech right versus the right.
I love that meme. Sorry, not to cut you off. There was one meme of like two swole dudes fighting each other, and one was like the tech bros and MAGA, and then like the left on the side just like watching them duke it out,
smoking a bong or hitting the bong or whatever.
Well, I think that's a really interesting dispute because the sort of center of agreement there is fuck the proletariat, fuck the actual working class. If you're born in the US or if you're an immigrant, fuck you. You are not worthy of our consideration.
You will work.
The only question is about the sort of professional class. Yeah. It's like, how are we going to bring in skilled professionals from other countries so we can pay them less than U.S. born coders or tech people or whatever?
Learn to code.
But there's no dispute about,
the millions of undocumented workers.
Right. Put them in a concentration camp, make them do slave labor, deport them, whatever. We do not consider them humans. We do not consider them part of this.
Yeah, they even said, I think when Miller was asked about separation of families, he's like, that's just too much. We're just going to deport the whole family. You know, like they're not like that, which was a big part of like Trump's policy, right? Which, obviously a lot of the immigration stuff that happened under Trump was not just like falling from the sky. A lot of it was set up in, under Obama. But like, I mean, Trump, what made him distinct in many ways was the separation of children and families. And Miller was like, we're just going to deport all of them. So I agree. Like, I think there's going to be a lot of chaos and uncertainty. And I listened to this NPR story about the current head of immigration was asked, what can Trump really do with his agenda given the infrastructure that exists, right, among like immigration, ICE, Border Patrol. And he gave kind of like this interesting rundown, and basically he could still do a lot, right? Like he could still do a lot. A lot of it will be difficult to do. A lot of it will be super expensive to do. So I wonder what kind of backlash will come to that. So for sure, I think with Trump, a lot of it is about spectacle, strong show force. Many of it may not happen, but something I'm thinking a lot about is like, I mean, we're entering this era where we're just like more uncertainty, more chaos, more weird shit. And I think perhaps going back to your initial point, John, is like maybe we should just like it's like take a breather and it's like, okay, what does this mean for what we want to do? Right? Because these are the kinds of things we could imagine continuing, deepening, getting worse under Trump. And I think in the past, it's been about the hysteria aspect, right? About the reaction. But how do we go beyond just reacting to the hysteria, to the uncertainty, to getting wrapped up in all of this? And how do we go back to the vision that we want, like how, and how do we start, you know, how do we start building, right? As opposed to just reacting.
One thing, and I think that Andy's touching on this difference between now and 2016. One thing is that we're not being asked to enlist in the resistance. There is going to be resistance. It's going to be like quotidian, like state versus federal, municipal versus state, municipal versus federal, like local cops, local prisons versus ICE. You know, there's going to be resistance. It's going to happen in the courts and it's going to happen in our political system. Unlike 2016, we're not asking, the Democrats are not asking us to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Right. Which is a freedom for us, which is like we don't have to be enlisted. We don't have to like show up en masse to big giant rallies. We can do our own thing, which comes back to John's question is, in light of 2024, what is our own thing? What could we even do if we could all agree on something? What potential is there for like what I'm saying is independent proletarian action right now? That's not just like getting in the streets and like throwing a paint can at a limousine in Washington, D.C.
So just to follow up, if I recall correctly, that the argument, the most significant organizational legacy of the Sanders campaign was the kind of explosion of size in DSA. I mean, that DSA became an organization of tens of thousands of members with some rather grandiose expectations of what it was going to do. As I further understand, and this is a lot from Jared and Jana, that more and more DSA became, you know, kind of essentially a left arm of the Democratic Party. That it kind of, it was not much more than that. There was no kind of independent socialist working class action undertaken by DSA, although perhaps there was some isolated things with the Libertarian Socialist Caucus and the Commie Caucus, although, you know, I can't understand why you would pick, you know, housing rental organizing as being your national priority if you were the Commie Caucus for DSA. But nonetheless, that whole kind of moment then, to the extent it was real at all, well, we talk about that, was squandered. I mean, what's left? What's the evidence of what did you do with 8 years now of time that you had on your hands, given arguably a more favorable, I mean, when SDS began in 1963, 64, I mean, and if you recall, in 1964, when Johnson ran for re-election, okay, the SDS slogan was part of the way with LBJ, because his slogan was all the way with LBJ, and they said no. But SDS went from an organization probably of 20,000 in 1963, 64, of 700,000 or 800,000 5 or 6 years later. Now, yeah. They did something with what was handed them. Now, they had the good fortune of having a war that was, you know, kind of going on. Although I just read.
And they also have a war in 2024, too. Yeah.
I mean, you know how many Americans are fighting, you know, inside the IDF now and are demanding that they get American military benefits?
Wow.
20,000.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
How come not one of us, okay, tortured the shit out of their families, okay, over the course of the last couple of years? Why didn't we make it impossible for their fathers or mothers to go take a shit, okay, without kind of encountering us screaming at them, okay, calling their sons and daughters, you know, war criminals? The opportunities are...
Well, these people are still being doxxed, you know, so we'll see if stuff like that happens, but I think with...
Well, you may know more about it than I do, honestly, yeah, because I go to sleep at 8:30, too.
I'm not sure. That's not maybe the sort of action I would co-sign, but I do think part of what the SDS did well was that they had a manifesto. They had, like, a revolutionary vision of changing the United States, the Port Huron Statement, right? And DSA never really, I mean, Bhaskar wrote the Socialist Manifesto, which I think is good, but it's a little bit wonky, you know, it's a little bit like how democratic socialism can still win. And it just didn't really capture a generation in the same way. And to the extent that
who did that?
Bhaskar Sankara, yeah. Who's one of the central DSA figures.
Jacobin guy, yeah. Okay.
To the extent that it did, or like, you know, Chapo, I think, or the Dirtbag Left, or, you know, the figures of this moment of which we were a part, this really never came up with a plausible worldview combined with a movement that everybody felt like they could join And part of that is just like the times, like the resistance just didn't continue to like surpass the Democratic Party's bounds. And I think part of it is just like the way the politics works now is a lot different from what the left is able to theorize. And that's part of why like me and a few people were so sucked into understanding the George Floyd uprising, is because although a lot of people interpreted it as simply a left thing or a Democratic Party thing, and they're totally wrong, we sort of saw it as something a little bit similar to the schizophrenic and diffuse nature of our times, but combined with massive collaboration between cities, between people, between races, between generations. And so we saw something there as like a kind of alchemy between like, yeah, this diffuse killer violence and like proletarian collaboration. And so obviously I think it was a lesson to a lot of people that doesn't work, because it didn't lead to any actual change. But I think we're going to see, and this is my prediction for 2025, we're going to see a lot of weirdness coming from not just the Trump administration, but like how the entire world reacts to these irredentalist right-wing powers, and how like the world order starts to reshift and reconfigure without any sort of legalistic logic in place anymore. It's just, we're going to see the anarchy of the market. We're going to see the anarchy of nation states and blocks. And so we're going to see some social anarchy as well. And it's not going to make sense from a traditional left-wing standpoint.
I think that's exactly right. And I think we should be cruel to ourselves. I think we're all guilty. I think we're all implicated. But
wait, I thought we agreed before that you were the only one who was guilty.
I am the guiltiest of all, goddammit. But we're all guilty a little bit. But you
not
know,
one amongst you are free of sin.
let ye who cast the first stone who's free of sin.
They hated Sean because he told them the truth.
Like, think about the hole that we had to dig ourselves out of from the 20th century, right? Like the actually existing socialism that stares us in the face now is free market Stalinism over in China. Some people want to glom on to that, even though there's no internationalism there. It doesn't even pretend to be internationalism, except maybe Belt and Road Initiative. But like the other great history we have hanging over our heads is the 20th century history of like social democracy. Either social democracy with gulags or without gulags. You either get your Soviet social democracy, everyone gets a job, everybody, you know, gets decent pay, everybody gets a cheap apartment, whatever, right? With gulags. Or you get it like Scandinavia style without. And like both of these models, we all lived through 1991. We saw social democracy with gulags fall apart in front of us. I don't think anybody was really prepared that for the last 10 years, where like the other social model, like capitalist mixed economy social democracy, would also fall apart. It's falling apart in the places where it was supposed to be a model, in Scandinavia. It's literally falling apart as we speak. So to give like a cut a little slack to the DSA people, which is to say all of us, because we're all implicated in the DSA moment, in the Bernie moment, whether we were on board or off board, right? We're all implicated in that. We all had our parts to play in it, right?
Did any of us join? I did not.
I didn't join.
I almost joined the commie caucus.
It's okay. If you did join, that's fine.
But I think we all maybe opened up the join page.
Balked at the last moment.
And also, I just want to say,
I think we should get Jared here and put him on the spot.
But you know what I mean, though, right?
Like we're talking about uncharted waters. I think we've been in uncharted waters since the Bernie moment. We thought we were in charted waters, but we were actually in uncharted waters. Like, we were watching the 20th century end up until like this last year, I think.
But just to put, do you think that there's anywhere across the big globe, okay? A lot, you know, they're not millions of left-wing communists, okay, but there are hundreds of thousands, arguably. There's enough to do something. And you have the kind of, have you read much of Andreas Malm? He's a pretty crazy guy. I saw him once in a video thing, and he was pretty scary. I don't know if you ever saw him talk about how he gets off. It's just almost, it's like a heroin rush when I see what the people in Gaza do when they kind of get these IDF tanks in their red triangle, and they go 1, 2, 3, boom!
Yeah.
say belong. It's been good to know you. And he was really kind of excited about it, seeing it happen. But anyway, he has, you know, he's not the only one. He actually has a kind of an organized vision for what it is people should do. All right. Now, it's not the one that I have, if people ask me. And that same thing is true for Brian Palmer up in Canada. And for, you know, it's even oddly enough true for the kind of the angry workers of the world folks, although I think that they've had their difficulties over the course of the last year, that people actually do have organized thoughts about what to do. And I don't know that we have as much of that as we need to start. I mean,
what's the insurgent notes line?
Oh, now that's a tricky on that question. Remember, okay, at the moment, there's only an insurgent note. actually, there's something really interesting about that question, which is this is not the right time to talk about it. That I can get people to do things relatively easily to commemorate Lauren, to acknowledge, including what you guys did. You know that when you did the podcast about it and more, and that's not hard, and we're actually making, Lord knows, some progress finally on kind of collecting and cataloging Lauren's papers. You know, we kind of have someone who's going to start working on that, which is a giant step forward. But on the other hand, I don't have an editorial group that I can assemble who can kind of help run Insurgent Notes with me, because, you know, and one of the things about Lauren was terrible, really terrible at organizational matters. He was always like upset about how come Insurgent Notes never became successful. I used to say, we never did a fucking thing that could have possibly led to us being successful. No, where do you think success comes from? Is it is it a magic wand? Success. No, he's not the only one. Okay, Lauren was rather, Noel was not much better at organizational stuff either. But anyway, I'm at a disadvantage in trying to think through what those issues and possibilities are, in part because I don't think I'm capable of doing it on my own. That's not the kind of role. I've been at this, as you know, as Andy knows, for a long time. I've been, you know, trying to, you know, in one way or another, organize stuff to get things to happen, sometimes with some success, sometimes with no success. But it seems to me it's the most pressing issue that we have at the moment. Far more important, for example, than preparing to fight back against Trump and to, you know, help. There are things to do about that too, but it's our own self-organizational work that's the most important thing to do.
But I just want to go back for a minute, John, because I do think it's important to also recognize that, you know, a lot of like organizing projects are mundane, boring. It's like there's not a lot of sexiness, you know, and I think like a lot of the spontaneity stuff, it's like it's very alluring, right? Because you're like riot fun, you know, and it's like organized people to come together to like think through something, to talk something, you know, it doesn't seem so exciting, right? But I do want to go back to like some of the struggles that we can potentially see, because I don't necessarily see them as like necessarily just anti-Trump. I actually see them as important flashpoint struggles that will affect a lot of people, with the potential to affect a lot of people, that could also bring together radicals, right? I mean, I think for me, I don't necessarily care in like, you know, in these like, and I think more and more people don't care about these like sectarian fights in the left, right? I mean, I think whatever vision of people, our vision of revolution is marred a lot by the past, right? So we're kind of like figuring out, you know, what is the vision that we want, right? But we're only going to come to that like by meeting each other. And I think like the anti-deportation struggles provide a really important point, coming together, right? So yeah, in the moment, resisting, you know, watching out for ICE, forming some rapid response team, but also like meeting each other. There's a lot of radicals. I think about this all the time. I think about the radicals that may be disillusioned with DSA. I mean, DSA to some degree, right, for better or worse, right? It wasn't just, first of all, it's very different in different cities, right? So in New York is all about like the Democratic Party and running for office, but other cities is not like that, right? They also, you know, a lot of people also left over, like, you know, is the, you know, Gaza and Palestine, right? Like, so many people have defected. Even those who have stayed, I just think we're in this moment where we could actually reconstitute a lot of, like, our milieus and our circles. And I don't know, guys, it's not optimism. I'm just like, I sometimes get frustrated with the conversations about, like, the vibes going forward are just going to be weird, but they're going to be weird. Like, we're in late stage capitalism, you know, it's like, this is just our moment, but it's like, this could also be an opportunity to just meet each other and to just, you know, get our networks in check. Right. There's folks that I know that do awesome, you know, stuff around tenant organizing or, you know, local mutual aid groups. I think people want to do something and to be part of something, but we're not really creating those spaces to come together. And I think what actually ends up happening too, that there's a lot of burnout. It takes so much time and then we get frustrated, but that's just the reality of it. The reality is that you're going to live a lifetime of a lot of failed projects. And I'm okay with that. Like, that's just what it is. And then, you know, you kind of figure it out as you go along, but I'm not willing to let go of this idea that we just, I don't know, we just like tune into the nihilism and, you know?
I think you got to do both. I mean, I'm part of Woodbine, which is a space that's dedicated to this, and getting the space in check is definitely part of my project right now. Keeping it ready for whatever is coming and like open and reflexive to whatever is coming. Making it not only open, but also open to people who kind of understand what's going on, have their finger on the pulse and aren't just like leftist nerds. Have these organizations. We got to be ready. We got to have people we can talk to and figure out how to expand them and like network with one another. So this is for sure what we got to be doing now. It's always been the case.
So, John, I want to make clear, I mean, I don't disagree with you at all on that. And I'm not especially pessimistic. I'm not especially hypercritical about what anybody is or is not doing, you know, right now. All I'm saying is that I want to chart out a set of organizational strategic priorities for people to focus their time and effort on as they go forward. And that would include things like, I was actually going to ask you after you talked about your kind of party, you know, function at Woodbine last night, how is Woodbine doing? I mean, the only thing I know about it is I give them money every month.
That's a good thing.
They're too far away. I want them to move to me.
Yeah. Well, I live close, John. Don't worry about that.
Well, Jared's coming to talk on the 19th, so you should definitely come pay us a visit, and you can see for yourself.
Well, you know what's weird about my life is that the reason why my daughter drove me tonight is that I can't navigate being outside in the dark, okay, at this time of day. Because I can't see well enough, okay, to not fall. And that really spooks me. I mean, and it really, so that if I, you know, kind of go over to Woodbine to see Jared, you know, speak, that's a big, that's not just going over there on a Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock.
All right, we'll try to figure something out for you.
Problem, but I kind of, that there are, you know, kind of things that really frustrate me. Yeah. But I think, though, that the kind of, it would be really valuable to have a series of ongoing conversations and discussions amongst people who, you know, however they be connected or configured, about, well, what would you do if, you know, where would you place your bets? What would you kind of focus your energies on? What do you think you need to better understand in order to move forward than what you already know or understand?
It's an important conversation. Yeah.
And all I want to say is that the way that, so if we take advantage of this moment, right, the fact that, yes, there's going to be a lot of chaos and a lot of it is going to just be legal, let's be honest, right? Like, going to be tied up in the courts. But that doesn't mean that everyday folks are not going to feel the uncertainty of, like, what deportations will mean, what being a school teacher would mean in this moment when a lot of your funding is tied up with federal money. Like, there's just so much going on. And what I'm saying is, like, why can't we also use this moment to, like, to have those conversations are only going to happen if we talk with each other in this moment of people, you know, wanting to fight back, also being like uncertain, being scared, being anxious. I think there's a lot of anxiety more than anything.
Fair enough.
I don't know. I do think that this is like an interesting moment to just like to come together, to have those conversations and to have those spaces. And I think to not also be hard on ourselves, like, you know, organizing, doing all this stuff is hard work. I mean, it's a commitment. It comes and goes. things fail, things fall apart. But I don't know. I'm really optimistic about this moment because I think a lot of folks are they would belong to things if those things existed, you know. And I also think they only exist if we make it happen. So I don't know. I'm kind of committed to that. So I'm excited about that going forward.
The ILC, I think.
What is the ILC?
The Independent Labor Club of North America. Part one of the.
That's a lot of territory.
Yeah, it's a big territory. Yeah, but you want to go internationalist immediately. You don't want to go of United States. It's terrible. You want to be NAFTA coded, but like one of the basic precepts, you know, that brought the ILC together is that we're not ready for a party, and all these sects that exist are not parties; they're sectarian groups. And if you're serious about having a party, which would be the venue where you could have ongoing discussions, proactive discussions, if you want to have a policy platform, right? If you want to have a series of things that everybody fights for and believes in, if you want to have a take on police brutality, you want to have a take on immigrant labor, you want to have all these things that a party has to have, there are certain elementary building blocks that need to be in place first. I feel like what you're talking about, John, is working on those building blocks. And that's the kind of terrain that the ILC, Woodbine, and many, many other groups are working on right now, which is like we all have this horizon in mind. For many people, it's communism. For me, it's the party. Just having like a truly independent, autonomous, self-organized working class institution capable of pushing working class politics forward, of creating working class politics out of working class issues, that just having that would change the entire scope of our conversation. Because we'd be talking about in what way the subsidiary civil social organizations that exist, the trade unions that are affiliated with, the way in which like our internal democracy is working, the way that Woodbine as a space, as a mutual aid network, fits in with like the larger question, how Insurgent Notes is an organ of the party or isn't, is outside and critical or inside and critical. All of these questions we could be having if we had a party, but we don't. And let's not pretend that we do. Let's not pretend that having like a geopolitical take on what's happening in Russia, Ukraine in the year 2024, God, 2025, when there is no party, that nobody's part of a party, right? That is a substitute for real politics. Because just having a take on that war right now is not politics. It's a geopolitical opinion, but you don't have any movement, any party to back that opinion up or make it real besides just your own particular opinions about Putin or Zelensky or hegemony or the multipolar world or whatever. We've all got opinions, baby. I got plenty of them. A lot of good they've done me.
Who else is in the ILC?
Who else?
Yeah, broad strokes. I mean, just
We've got 4 or 5 chapters throughout the U.S. Phoenix, New Jersey.
You got Ross Wolf in there.
Ross Wolf's in there.
Yeah, nice.
We don't have a lot of like luminaries, leftist luminaries. Jamie Merchant's in it.
Some heavy hitters.
Sure, Alex Gendler. You may have heard of Alex Gendler.
I met Alex a couple of times.
Rax King.
She's a heavy hitter. Steve Wright, the historian of autonomism, is part of our Melbourne chapter. Steve Wright.
He's a member in Australia.
yeah. In Australia, we have a Melbourne chapter.
I'm in touch with Steve.
He's a great guy.
Gives us takes from the future. All right, listen, speaking of, Jana sent me some takes from the future via her mother. And
what?
I think that would be a fun thing to talk about on the other side of the paywall. Some visions of what 2025 and the more distant future have in store for us, including a communist horizon in a few decades.
Or a party horizon in a few decades.
So, yeah, let's go behind the paywall, and we'll be talking about
Baba Vanga,
the Balkan Nostradamus.
Yeah. All right, let's have
She's
at
real.
It.
All right, patreon.com/theantifada. Please sign up for $5, $10, $15, And especially we appreciate if you sign up for the entire year. You get a discount when you do, and it really helps us out. So, see you on the other side of the paywall.
See you on the other side, folks. Thanks for listening. Take a truce, I'll take them to hell with me. If that money got in the hands of a crash dummy, could jeopardize my family and burden the ones who love me. Niggas mad cause I decided not to pretend. Y'all stay politically correct, I'ma do what I did. Ain't no sympathy here, this shit's hilarious. It's a lot of opinions, but no power to carry it. 2025, they still moving on some scary shit. Tell them quit their job and pay the real niggas they severance. Don't insult my intelligence, I'm not just for the television. Teleport the bullets rolling, dig up all my relatives. Okay, nigga, let's settle it. These niggas been fake loyal. Since y'all pandering to choose a side, let me do it for you. Okay, fuck you. Hip hop, I watch the parties just die. Niggas cackling about, while all of y'all is on trial.